and welcome to the Action Movie Landfill, a spin-off from The Odd Job Pod, where three people who absolutely love James Bond also discuss their love of action movies. And we've gone through many good bad ones. We dive into the landfill of the period between the mid-80s to the very early 2000s-ish, a little bit loose at some places, but things where you dive in and you look for the Touchstone logo and you bring it out and you go, is this any good or not? And does it deserve to be rescued from action movie landfill? And each podcast, each of us people who are on this podcast will pick a film, and it's my turn to pick a film this time. So we will be discussing the dystopian-ish sci-fi thriller with Arnie, The Running Man. And I've been excited about this because if you're a regular listener, you know that we've had a couple recently where maybe we've stretched the definition of action, we've stretched the definition of landfill, but I feel we're on safe territory here. And you know, to join me in this safe space is Graham Sibley. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Gary.
And Terry DeFellin. Hello, Terry.
Hello, Gary. I'm still waiting for my Running Man board game, however.
That's a good point. It's one thing, you know, when you're watching a film and there's something that starts getting at you that really shouldn't. And part of me has been, what would the Running Man board game actually look like? Because, you know, it's clearly something that had I been living in a dystopian society, roughly about now, and that board game was out and on TV, I suspect I probably would have bought it. So, you know, what would be in the Running Man board game? I don't know. This is an interesting question to start off. Not one that I was intending to, but, you know, you go with the flow on the podcast.
Well, I wonder, are you playing as stalkers or runners? What would you be thinking? What would your immediate thought be there, Gary?
I mean, you'd clearly have to have at least probably, you know, three people minimum. Well, maybe not. It's might be a bit like Hero Quest potentially, where, you know, you've got sort of certain battle arenas set up and you've got to go through. I mean, you'd need other things other than just like a stalker and a runner. But I'm not quite sure how it would work. But this is why I'd like to, you know, if anybody wants to create a Running Man board game, I'd certainly be interested. Terry, would you buy it?
It's for to answer Graham's question, it'll be because we're living in a fascist society, so it'll be a family game. Father and son will probably, and the daughter and the mother will take turns, and the board will be divided up into its four different quadrants, probably with the game show studio in the middle, with Killian and his own holding his arms aloft. I've actually thought this through, alarmingly. I love the fact that he kept highlighting the board game. Don't forget the Running Man board game, because you know that he's got like a warehouse full of those things unsold out the back.
It is the blankety blank checkbook and pen, isn't it?
It's terrific. It's absolutely terrific. Yeah.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. You look at the, these are people, what's been made here is definitely people who I think kind of understand, have a really good understanding of I think kind of game shows in general and society in general. And, you know, actually I was going to say, so Terry, it's set in kind of, you know, roundabout nowish, probably a little bit before 2017 it's meant to happen. So it's probably about 2019 is when we think it's set. 2019 in The Running Man actually doesn't really feel a long way away from 2024 today. That was my first and main takeout, that when you've got these dystopian sci-fi, obviously Total Recall is a long way off. I'm sure Elon Musk will have something to say about that, but it definitely is a way off. The Terminator is also probably, well, maybe not quite such a way off now. But this is a film which probably has aged better in terms of its prediction in the future than maybe we might have given credit for back in the 80s.
Yeah, I think the film, it's based on a pretty solid premise for sort of like dystopian satire. This is a left-wing film in my book. This film is a left-wing political film. It's got at least certainly in terms of its analysis, it's got a very straightforward. It's got an impoverished underclass which is being horrifically abused and exploited by a capitalist class backed up by an oppressive fascistic government and being underpinned by a wealthy middle class and a compliant media class. It's absolute textbook Marxist left-wing analysis of modern capitalist society. And so in that respect, you know, it's not, you know, it is, if you're into that kind of politics, if that's how you see the world, then you'll look at The Running Man and you'll say, yeah, this is completely prescient. This is just how it is. Everything is perhaps a bit exaggerated, certainly for the United States. I don't know. Perhaps there are parts of the United States where this isn't actually exaggerated. I don't believe that the U.S. police force go around gunning down food rioters. I don't. But certainly the U.S. police force do go around gunning down its citizens. So, you know, I mean, in that respect, I think it's quite prescient. I think there are certain aspects of its analysis, and certainly it's when we come to the film's denouement, we can talk about how that goes down. But I mean, it is easy to look at this film from, you know, and go back in time and say, yeah, you know what, that feels right. It could have been talking about contemporaneous 1987 as well. It's just an analysis of society and a left wing one at that. And that's why I feel that also the film's storytelling and its building blocks as a film are solid, because irrespective of whether you are left wing or not, it's a good strong analysis for building a film and a story around.
Definitely. And Graham, from, you know, to build on Terry's build about the build in there, a lot of what it's touching on, whilst as Terry said, it's it is a little bit exaggerated. Again, when you look at where we are today, and you know, manipulation of editing, and you can't really trust a lot of things because of fake news, alternative facts, and all that. Again, it's I remember watching it for the first time, going, oh yeah. I mean, I can see when I was, you know, I would have been probably about 12 or something when I first saw it. I remember I watched it late at night on when I was staying over at my grandparents, and going, this is really cool, because obviously as a 12-year-old boy, this would have been a massively cool film. But I do remember going, okay, yeah, that might seem a bit far-fetched. But now when you look at that kind of manipulation of the footage of the Bakersfield massacre, and what's done. Obviously, it's very handy to have the raw footage just sitting around in a production studio, which, you know, is also probably very accurate, because it's the type of thing that oppressive yet inept governments would probably do, type of government that might well also just store the Ark of the Covenant in a warehouse somewhere. But yeah, that kind of bit of, you know, the media lies to you is obviously a very classic trope. But the way that it's done, again, looking at it through 2024 eyes there, you just go, yeah, that's pretty much spot on. And it's not a massive stretch. In fact, it probably goes on in some countries exactly like that today.
Well, the whole scene when they make up Richard's, in inverted commas, death scene, that whole deep fake that they produce, it's very now, isn't it? That's just something that we're just getting used to at the moment. And there's little things like the way that, you know, she commands her Alexa when she comes home, and all her smart devices get switched on, and this is spot on. All right. Instead of the internet, she's got CFAX on a CRT. But maybe she's into the classics. Who knows? Maybe that's what she's got there. The film does do that, and as Terry said, it's because it's built on such a solid base, which has which delivers a lot of meaning. Whether all of that meaning is carried over in the directing of Starsky and of the leading man Arnold Schwarzenegger is another thing. I mean, they do a great job at just bringing across a great popcorn film, and that's what it is, really. mean, we can say all we like about the hidden political subtone here, but it's not. It's a popcorn movie. It could have been better. It could have been a lot better as far as that is concerned. I mean, it doesn't need to be because it's a great action film. So we can just have that and it'll be fine. But I don't think it's got the longevity of, say, something like RoboCop, which came out 4 or 5 months before it and handled that whole sort of dystopian but living in a media society better than this does. RoboCop is a better film. And if you want to argue with that, then great. We've got a podcast. But I think had Verhoeven been given this film instead of Total Recall, what sort of film would it have been then? I mean, then you're really elevating it, I think. That's what I think. And I think then you're going to see something more scarier. I think that's when it really comes home about what the things have actually come to pass in this film and what could still come to pass in this film.
Yeah, I've just started thinking there about what a Verhoeven-directed Running Man would be, and holy shit, I would watch the hell out of that, because Total Recall is one of my favourites. RoboCop is a fantastic film. I'm not going to argue with you on that, because there is no argument there at all. Verhoeven and the Running Man would have been a match made in absolute cinematic heaven, I think, for sure. Terry, obviously, as Graham's kind of touched on there, the building blocks are there. It is a popcorn movie. There's probably elements of this film that don't necessarily hang together. Probably, the plot can be a bit paper thin in places. And also, while you said there's a lot of love gone into this, there is a kind of feeling for me that in slightly different hands in terms of the overall direction, you could have probably elevated this from a very enjoyable popcorn flick into a film that we might talk about a bit more, like your Total Recalls or your RoboCops.
I think if you're going to cast Arnie as your starring role, then I think that you're saying something about that film, and that is to say that this film is not likely to be a film of substance. It's likely to be a film that you're going to come along and watch. It's going to be an action film and you're going to be entertained first and foremost. Yeah, absolutely popcorn. This is not to say that Arnie hasn't been in films of substance, but I would suggest to you that oftentimes I think that there's stuff going on around. I think Terminator is a perfect example of a film of significant of substance, and Terminator 2 to an extent. Which Arnie plays a central role, but he plays the villain slash hero. I mean, there's the things going on around him. I think Arnie as an actor, I don't necessarily is able to carry those kind of films. I think it would have been interesting if they had cast a different kind of actor. I think Paul Michael Glazer has gone for that Verhoeven look in The Running Man. I think it's definitely, it's contemporaneous to the 1980s. That's what it looks, and it does visually look, feels like a lot of that. But I think that I also feel that with Arnie's politics and stuff like that, you wouldn't necessarily get. I don't know. I mean, Charlton Heston made Soylent Green and Planet of the Apes, two of the most political science fiction films ever. And that guy was massive Republican, spokesman for the NRA, very much out of kilter with an awful lot of the politics that two of his greatest of those films were brought across. So it doesn't necessarily exclude Arnie from making political films, but we know generally speaking, what kind of a guy he is. But I just not. And I love Arnie. I adore him. But I do know that he's not a tremendously good actor. And I just think that sometimes he's perfect for these kind of roles. And this is, as Graham has said, this could have been biting satire in the hands of a different director. Absolutely. With real subtext, But as it is, and it's gone, let's take a load of left-wing tropes and make an action film. And a science fiction action film out of it, because people like that kind of dystopian stuff. And it really is the sort of studio's response to that. And it's still tremendous fun. I absolutely love it.
I was going to say, for all that potential, I think valid criticism that this film perhaps actually doesn't have as much substance as others. For me, Graham, I think Terry's touched on a point which is absolutely, you know, core to this, which is it's just a lot of fun if you don't think too hard about it. So let's talk about what you enjoy about this film.
Oh, okay. Well, where to start, really? There is so much to enjoy about it. I think the pacing of it is, for one thing, because it doesn't let up, but doesn't do it in a way that just leaves you exhausted. It's not like a modern Marvel superhero film where it just the action sequences just go on forever and ever and ever, and you don't get a chance to draw breath. It gives the ensemble cast some element of interaction. It's not all just Arnie working there. There are a few things about it that you have to just go with. The fact that their secret base appears to be in the set of Running Man. Yeah, okay, just go with it. Just go with it. And the fact that their whole broadcasting system seems to be hidden inside this set, this 400 block set, which, you know, it's a big area, I suppose. You could probably do that, keep it always locked down. So there are things like that in there that I just enjoy deliberately ignoring, just so that I can enjoy the film for what it is, and that's just a load of very large men fighting with various things from the hire shop. It is fun. It is really sort of like the last film before health and safety really kicked in, wasn't it?
I mean, yeah, the health and safety consultant on The Running Man would have, you know, you can just imagine that, would have just had a devil of a time. You can imagine him going, oh, no, really? What? I mean, okay, I know we're going to be killing people, but, you know, do we really need the barbed wire there? And I reckon, you know, afterwards, that person would be going up to the network and going, look, I told you so. Here's my report. Here's what I said about putting the barbed wire there. It's not a good idea. Probably would have been treated in exactly the same way that Arnie treated the lawyer when he got to sign the contract as well, which is possibly, again, it's gratuitous, but it's a nice touch. Terry, the other thing that I, you know, for a dystopian film, and obviously there is, you know, there's a lot of violence in there, and obviously they've gone down the route, as you said, of cartoon violence, but the things that I just enjoy are the fact that they've gone, right, we just need to give Arnie one-liners consistently all the way through. And, you know, they're cringeworthy, but also this is part of the reason why I love this, is just that, well, he was hot-headed, wasn't he? and all the other, you know, the things that come out after the kills and everything else, it's, you know, they know what they're working with here, and they know their crowd, and they know the audience they're playing to, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm being completely honest, I feel the action sequences themselves are quite pedestrian. I don't believe I felt like that at the time at all, but I think they don't really hold up that well. I mean, and I think that's perhaps one of the reasons why, although this film is much loved, I don't know, it doesn't, I don't think it has that kind of enduring classic feel to it. And the one-liners, again, similarly, his delivery just seems to be a little bit off, and unfortunately you do have to put that down to direction, because that's all about the timing, you know, really, and the quality of the delivery. And I don't, you know, Paul Michael Glazer, not obviously hugely well known for being an actor rather than a director, and again, we have to wonder whether or not this film would have been a little bit better served if it had been directed by someone with a bit more experience of directing action films as well. Again, the more you think about it, the more Paul Verhoeven would have been an absolutely superb choice for this. I think that what really stands out for me amongst the many things that I really, really enjoy about this film is the audience reaction. I think that's the constant audience reaction, and going between the sort of like that, you know, the middle class yuppie bar, you know, the bookies, you know, and where the underclass, and then the studio audience, and then flipping between those as the action goes away, because even though the action sequences may not be necessarily the most convincing, the audience reaction to it as they as they're watching the narrative unfold is I think adds legitimacy to the action and helps the actual audience to sort of become a lot more engaged. And I think it's and it's also a really good way of, you know, it reinforcing to the audience the various structures within the movie, within the story, so that we can understand, you know, the various layers there. And I think that that's actually one of the better aspects of the direction and of the filmmaking was that side of thing, because I think, it just added an extra bit of legitimacy to the action and made you allow the audience to forgive any shortcomings that there might actually have been in those action sequences.
Yeah, there's as we've sort of said, Graham, there's a nice, even with the elements of the film, which, you know, might not necessarily be perfect, such as the gaping big plot holes, and that, you know, some of the direction could be a bit better. This is clearly a film where they've got very into their world and the attention to detail, and they've thought about what's going on around it. It's not just, they've almost like they've raced through the plot and then gone, oh, what else can we build in there? And to me, that's one of the film's strengths, that, you know, even where the bits where potentially the direction might not necessarily be as good as it could be, or, you know, you do have a few gaping big plot holes, you can tell that the filmmakers have really bought into the world that they've created in there, which to me is one of the film's strengths.
Yeah, and I think the reason why the plot is stretched a bit is because they kind of back themselves into a corner by putting themselves on this set. I mean, in the novel, it's not. It's the whole world is the set. So actually putting it in this sort of like gladiator arena paint them into a corner, but they get out of it and they make it work, and it gives it a sort of fantasy element, and to make it all part of the TV show as well. I'm with Terry. I quite like the cutting to the audience and seeing the different reactions and how they change and how they start rooting for Richards in it, and that's an important side of it. And you see films like 10 years later, you see Truman Show, a much more cerebral satire of television, does exactly the same thing. Does that whole thing of like cutting to the people watching to see what their reaction. It's like Gogglebox in action movie form, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, a very different type of Gogglebox. And Terry, let's talk about the casting in here, because you've got a fascinating set of casting going on in here, which I think for me kind of works. But when you've got pro wrestlers, you've got Mick Fleetwood, you've got Richard Dawson, you've got Yaphet Kotto, who is a fine actor, probably slightly wasted in this as well. It's certainly one of the more interesting, diverse casting books, I think, that any action film has had.
Yeah, I mean, it's got Jesse Ventura in it, and like any film with Jesse Ventura in it is going to be magnificent. It's the law. It's that's a UN resolution. Not even the Chinese voted against that law. That's a fact. I mean. Yeah, I mean, it's a terrific ensemble. It's got to be said, you know. And I mean, you know, Mick Fleetwood, who I thought actually nailed that role really, really well. I thought he was absolutely Mick. I thought Mick was a fantastic character. Didn't have much to do. Wasn't a particularly challenging role, but obviously a very, very pivotal one. He had some really good lines. As the sort of like the old guy who remembers the old days, you know, and just the whole Mr. Spock, you have the con thing. It's really good. And I mean, Yaphet Kotto, I mean, not a minor role by any means, but, you know, he's an actor of significant substance, probably thinking, well, how have I ended up in this sort of like, you know, cheap sort of like sci-fi action flick. But I don't think they put a foot wrong at all with the with any of the cast. In fairness, I think Maria Conchita Alonso is, you know, is terrific in that role as that sort of, you know, initially. I like the way it takes age, goes from being this kind of helpless sort of like, you know, completely bought in like middle ranking executive to being an Uzi toting rebel at the end of it. It's a fantastic arc. She's got a brilliant arc, probably the best in the film. It's like, you know, and she does it really, really well, given that actually she doesn't have as much screen time as all of that, because the film whistles along nicely. And Richard Dawson, I think perhaps we could spend a bit more time on, who's, you know, really, I mean, it's Dawson and Schwarzenegger's film. You know, I mean, these two guys have to carry this film off. Otherwise, the film kind of doesn't really work. And maybe we'll spend a bit of time just dwelling on Killian and Dawson. But I have to give, you know, honorable mention for Sven Dawson, who I thought was just, who just managed to carry off enough, you know, personality and humor, you know, in the role, you know, to just to make that whole thing work. And right at the very, very end, he's like, "I'm off to score some steroids." You know, well, nice one, Sven. You got your line absolutely right. You nailed it. And goodness for that. Goodness knows how long it took him to practice that. But that is an aspect of the film where I think they actually get it. They get it absolutely right. The casting is pretty much spot on. No one is miscast in this film.
Yeah, they've really gone with the you know, again, I think this comes to me to the point of the world that they've created, and they've, you know, you've got your actors in there, but then you've also got your, I wouldn't even necessarily call them stunt casting, because they've really, it feels like they've looked and gone, yeah, this is the type of person that we need for this role. And yeah, it ticks boxes, it works. And there's a lot I like. Again, yeah, I'd agree. I love Maria Conchita Alonso. The end, she's just literally just turns up like she's been holding an Uzi all her life and is incredibly confident with it. And that's just hilarious. It is. It's like, you know, where does she go from that? But yeah, let's talk about Killian Graham. It's, you know, for the film itself, you need a good villain or unpleasantness or big bad or whatever. And Richard Dawson, for me, really carries this movie through, because if you didn't have Richard Dawson, I think it would, or somebody who could actually bring Killian to life well, that's where the film had the potential to fall down, because he has to hold the film together through the non-action bits and to play up the unpleasantness, but also the TV show. And for me, he's just absolutely nailed that. It's one of the best performance in there, and he's got that absolutely totally spot on.
Totally, he is. He makes the film. He it's him who brings across everything about the satire of the film, because we can't rely on Arnie for that. He's the one. And for non-US audiences as well, it may not have the same impact of having Richard Dawson there, because Richard Dawson is the original host of a show called Family Feud, which over here is known as Family Fortunes. He is literally the American Bob Monkhouse, and yet he is in the middle of this action film, playing this game show host, and carrying it off and being a real sleazy dick in the background as well. So yeah, he just carries out all of that. Everything he does perfectly, spot on. If we could see it through the eyes of an American who have grown up watching him being a game show host rather than being that, I mean, many people may remember him. He appears in odd episodes of things, and he was a regular on Hogan's Heroes as well. But for most of the watchers in 1987 would have remembered him as a game show host throughout the last, well, the previous decade or so. That doesn't necessarily have the same impact for us watching it, but it doesn't matter anyway, because he delivers such a good performance in that role.
It really doesn't. And Terry, I mean, I know that you probably have some further opinions on Killian. But yeah, that this feels like it's you know, somebody who is not, obviously, you know, the role is perfectly written for him as well, being who he is. But this is somebody who looks like he's enjoying every moment of being on screen as well.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, it's a notoriously cutthroat both business showbiz, isn't it? And you know, working on a game show like that where you know, it's long running, there's lots of personalities, you know, there's a huge need and desire to keep the numbers up, keep the ratings up. You probably had to deal, and maybe to a certain degree had to become, the kind of guy who is in these, in you know, who makes up the characters, the behind the scenes, you know, in the behind the scenes sequences of The Running Man. There's nothing futuristic about all of that. I think that is a direct criticism criticism or piss take of media America, of the TV show business, of commercial television in the United States, you know, as is, I suppose. And you know, it's interesting, Graham talks about, you know, perhaps non-American audiences not quite necessarily appreciating that maybe back in 1987. But, you know, the fact that they use wrestlers as stalkers, or, you know, some of the wrestlers are stalkers to you know, and it sort of like plays into the kind of, you know, developing WWF as it was then, and the wrestling industry as a television entertainment thing, by taking them on to that nth degree. And these are the areas where I think the film succeeds in landing some blows that maybe, yeah, sort of like, you know, maybe other audiences might not necessarily appreciate at the time. But it's still all, you know, perfectly, you know, playful enough and fun. I mean, let's not get carried away. There'll be no one's going to be writing any essays on that aspect of the film. But to return to Richard Dawson, yeah, he's clearly reveling in it. He's probably using an awful lot of personal experience and bringing that into the character. And it's tremendous fun, and it probably must have been quite cathartic for him, I hope, to be able to do that. And again, I mean, it's like most of the people in this film, it looks like, and again, is why we perhaps quite think that maybe Paul Michael Glaser may not be the best director, but it does look like he had a happy set, for which, you know, is also a skill, you know, that directors have. If it's a happy set, then there's a good chance it'll be a happy movie, and then it has the best chance of being the best movie that it can be.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's it definitely feels like there's a lot of people who are enjoying themselves in there. So Graham, let's talk a bit about Arnie as well in this, because you said that, you know, a lot of the good Arnie movies are where things kind of happen around him, and perhaps potentially, you know, he has his strengths and his flaws, and, you know, well, to be fair, we wouldn't be doing this podcast if we didn't enjoy Arnie films. But there was Christopher Reeve was meant to be attached to it at some point. You know, there is, he obviously, when you have Arnie, you have a certain type of film in mind. Is he the right choice for this film, or would have been served slightly better? You know, it might be sacrilege to ask that question, but it's certainly for me the one element where, while I enjoy it a lot, I did have questions going, I wonder how this would have fared with a slightly different actor in the role.
Well, yeah, if you're going to have Christopher Reeve in the role, you're not going to have Jesse Ventura as one of his main adversaries, are you? It's, it would be entirely different. I think the treatment for the film that Christopher Reeve was meant to be making is very, very close to the book. So it's that story as well. So, yeah, a completely different film. And you're going to get... So you're probably going to make it for a hell of a lot cheaper. This one ran in at 30 million, which, when you think that's twice what the budget of RoboCop was, then you can see this wasn't actually a cheap film to make. But how much of that went to Arnie, I don't know, because by this time, he was commanding the money. This was. Just after Predator, wasn't it? And this came out same year as Predator, I think, this one. So he is becoming a big star. Obviously, his arc is still on the rise, and he starts making family movies after this. I mean, this is By the time he gets around to making Total Recall, that's Total Recall is sandwiched between Twins and Kindergarten Cop. So you can see the where he is going when he goes into the 90s, and he makes lots of very, very big budget films then. And people hire him because, as Killian says, you know, his biceps alone will put 10 points on the ratings. So that's what he's there for. And people don't go to watch... Well, people didn't go watching 1987 in the dying embers of Reagan's administration, go and watch Running Man to be lectured on socioeconomics. They went to go and watch a film about about Arnold beating up wrestlers, basically. And oh, look, there's Jim Brown. It's that's what it's all about. So yeah, I mean, they obviously took a turn at some point. They probably said, right, okay, well, we can make something, you know, like, akin to like Network or something, or what will become The Truman Show, or even The Hunger Games, something like that, for a very, very modern equivalent of this. But that's part of the film where it doesn't have the confidence. It doesn't have the confidence of its budget. It's still rooted in that sort of like B-movie action trope and things like that. So you wouldn't have been surprised if this was, a John Carpenter. But John Carpenter would have made it better. But it's got that sort of feel to it. That sort of, Roger Corman. Yeah, that sort of thing.
I think it's the set itself, the Running Man set, is not terribly ambitious when you consider the money that is being spent. I would have liked to have seen much, much wider angled shots with much more lavish sets and much more lavish vision of what that would have looked like. And I think that's where the movie lets it down. I think where the movie excels in its sets is outside of the Running Man, is the portrayal of the world that we are living in of 2019. You know, I think that they put quite a lot of thought and energy into that. They're borrowing heavily from other areas. Yeah, absolutely. Of course, this is not an original film by any means, but they're putting in, there's some glorious matte painting going on the lovely the brutalist sort of like futuristic matte paintings, really, really nice, really, really enjoyable. But yeah, when you get down to the actual hub, the where the action takes place, it's really dark, it's dank, it's claustrophobic, and it deserves a little bit better. I just think about Valkyrie, that character, and his car, and that, and I think that there were moments there when that could have been magnificent, but in fact it was a little bit cheap. Unfortunately, I mean, these are minor criticisms, it should be said, but nevertheless, we are here to discuss this film.
I think that gives it that sort of feel of straight to video in a lot of respects, where things could have been more expensive. Other films of the time were doing it better. So it's not all about like us, you know, being completely immersed in CGI for the last 20 years, just expecting more from it.
No, absolutely. No, I mean, like there were plenty of movies around. I mean, as you say, RoboCop made much, much better use of its set on a significantly lower budget. So yeah, it could have been done and it wasn't. And that's a shame.
Terry, it feels that from, you know, I think again, Graham, to me, you've got it spot on, but Terry, this feels like it is, you know, it's got a big budget, but this is at heart, you know, if it was, you know, if it was kind of marketed or sold as a really, really good B-movie, it potentially might even have a bit more, it's aged, I think it's actually aged relatively well, but this is a very, very, very good quality B-movie with an A-movie budget at this time, rather than necessarily being a, you know, a big budget blockbuster that is going to conquer all. It's it's an interesting kind of balance between two ambitions of trying to make a blockbuster. On one hand, you've got probably part of it is trying to make a blockbuster. On the other hand, you've got a very B-movie sensibility that sits underneath it, which, you know, potentially is one of the bits that doesn't really resolve, and potentially one of the reasons, maybe I'd suggest, why it doesn't have quite the same legacy and appreciation as some of the other action films of that era.
No, it's, I mean, it's not going to be sort of like left-wing hipsters, sort of like guilty pleasure Running Man. I mean, it at some point, it was, I think that it was going to be a B-movie film of substance, possibly attached with a director, you know, who made these kind of films. There would have been, the subtext would have been, there would have been some subtext to it. It would have been trying to tell you something. But I genuinely don't think this film is trying to tell you anything at all. It's just using that, the politics, just simply as a backdrop to tell an exciting story for people to go and watch in a very, very harmless way. But presumably at some point, as Graham alluded to, when Christopher Lee, that would have been amazing. Christopher Reeve had been was attached to it. I suspect it was going to be a different film, but they've looked at it and gone, why don't we just make some kind of futuristic sci-fi drama and get Arnie in and just like pump a load of more money in it, and then we'll make more money out of it that way. And that's probably gone, okay, yeah, we'll do that. So perhaps the essence of the satire, that dystopia, that there is still parts of it there, but it's not. It doesn't necessarily translate itself into that. Again, that's all good. This is a great film. There's nothing wrong with that at all. There are some interesting moments in it as well. There's when Richards and Amber are trying to get a flight to Hawaii, and they're having difficulty. They're doing the whole thing with the passports and stuff like that. And you've got these sort of like blue rinse, sort of like, you know, boomers effectively behind them, entitled boomers. And you're just thinking, that could be 2019 right now. That, you know, that is, you know, and these are things, but hopefully you feel that perhaps these are things that are sort of left over from the original script, perhaps, or that sensibility that's coming through. But that's not what this film is. I would be really interested to see what the remake does and what direction that they go in with it. Obviously, it's not they're going to readapt the original novel. They're not remaking this film. But it might be interesting to see whether or not they go in a different direction there, because obviously Edgar Wright is directing it, which suggests that it will be, you know, a film of substance. But I don't know. I think there'll be plenty of people who will say, "Oh no, this is the better version."
It's funny, Graham, because there is, as I think we've all established, they've set out to make, you know, an entertaining action film, an entertaining, you know, popcorn movie, which I think they've succeeded in. And yet there is a lot in there where, you know, films like this, I would argue, probably are not meant to age quite as well as potentially this one has done, because of the world that it's created and the prescience in there. You know, we used to sci-fi, we look back on some stuff and still go, yeah, you know, it wasn't that funny at the time. But we're looking at this and going, yeah, feels relevant. Whether that's by accident or design, or you've just got some very, very future thinking people there, it enhances the film a lot more. It's fascinating watching this film now versus, you know, when I watched it in the early 90s, that just how whilst there are flaws with it, it's aged surprisingly well, probably more well than I think anybody who made or watched a review did at the time may have potentially envisaged it doing.
Well, I think one of the keys of sci-fi, especially sci-fi of the near future, is to basically tell a story of today, but give it the backdrop of some future, well, give it a futuristic backdrop. And so if you, the more you make the world something that is recognisable, then you're always off to a good start, because it immerses people a lot quicker. So it doesn't actually push technology on that much. I mean, yeah, there are a few things in there that work really well, but when you compare it to, say, like the house of 2015 in Back to the Future 2, you know, when they're like having their own home fax machine, is it where they really try hard to sort of like push forward on to what people will have in their own homes, and yeah, like people are having a coffee machine at home now, which is commonplace, and yeah, their own take of what the internet will be like. I mean, these aren't a million miles, these aren't far fetched at all, really. So yeah, that helps with it, and I think it does, as you said earlier. I mean, if you make a few wrong turns, then all of a sudden the whole thing starts to lose credibility. I mean, the home fax machine in Back to the Future 2 is just hilarious, isn't it? It's when we look back at it now, the technology that came and went in the intervening years of those films. Yeah, and so, but I think as well is that it still relies on people at home watching television, and of course people are still at home watching television, and because it can't explain things like social media or things like that or celeb culture, but it does that in the frame of the mid 80s, and we had all that in the mid 80s, and this is the big age of WWF, as it was, wrestling. So it was all about sports entertainment, and really this film as well, it's just kind of remake of Rollerball, isn't it? And if you want satire, then go and watch Rollerball. They did it better in that. So yeah, and if it had been perhaps a bit more serious, if they had got a more I'll say serious actor, but a genuine actor in the leading role, then maybe you're just saying, well, you know, you're just James Caan now, aren't you? And this is just another Rollerball, isn't it? So I think in those respects, the actual futuristic aspects of this are very lightweight. So I think that helps it be absorbed more. But yeah, there were things in it that I kept thinking about. Oh yeah, that is very, very now. Even when Killian threatens Arnie with being cancelled. Yeah, you heard it there first, didn't you?
Yeah, totally. And I think it to me is one of the things that makes it quite enjoyable. And Terry, you've got you know, I would hesitate to say it's been a direct influence, but you can see, you know, you can draw a very, very clear line from The Running Man through to some of the biggest shows and films that we've had over the last, you know, decade or so. And I'm thinking, obviously, Hunger Games, we've mentioned a bit, but also Squid Games as well. You can draw those lines into there, and, you know, they would have probably happened anyway without The Running Man, but you can definitely... I don't know whether the makers watched or, you know, how aware they were or how much they looked in it, but there definitely feels, you can see that influence or the kind of themes in there. And again, probably themes as much as anything else, but you watch The Running Man, and then you watch Hunger Games or Squid Games, and you go, yeah, I can, you, they comfortably sit next to each other. And if you like those films and that show, then you're going to like The Running Man as well, albeit probably with less substance.
Yeah, it goes all the way back to ancient gladiators, doesn't it? I mean, it's the idea of sports participants killing each other, but also the idea of sports as a method of social control as well, which goes all the way back to Roman times. Are you not entertained? That's literally what it means. And as big sports fans ourselves, this is something, and I think as considered sports fans ourselves, this is something that we are very, very aware of. That conflict that we have, that we know that what we are doing is not only something that we love, but it's also a method of social control. It's something of an opiate. And so that story has been told for thousands of years. You know, and whether it be in fiction or whether or not it be in real life. And so it's nothing new whatsoever. So it's very familiar and it's very, very comfortable. It's a very comfortable concept. And so it's no wonder that filmmakers and storytellers go back to it time and time again, because it is a timeless trope, and one that is always, always worth exploring, and always will tend to evolve as society and civilizations evolve as well. This is what I mean. It's falling on, it's the foundations for these stories are absolutely rock solid, which really help make the movie, you know, a success and a successful watching and entertaining film.
Definitely. So I think, Blake, we're coming to wrap up in conclusion, but Graham, I think there's, you know, my take up from this is, one, it's a fantastically enjoyable film. And if you haven't seen it, I still think some of the films that we have in Landfill, I suspect, or some of the Bond films as well, you go, if you showed that to an audience today, you know, somebody who's not familiar with it, they might go, yeah, there's, you know, you wouldn't, you probably wouldn't start somebody off on, say, Octopussy, for example, if you were trying to introduce them into Bond.
I might.
From a modern audience sensibility, shall we say. but this one, I kind of feel, again, as Terry's alluded to, it's got a bit of a timeless quality to it that I think you could probably take somebody who you know, might look at some of the 80s films or might go, yeah, you know, not sure about some of these. This one, I feel you could show, and most people would sit down and go, yeah, even if they wouldn't rate it highly, they would probably, you know, happily sit and watch it. And it certainly doesn't feel out of kilter with today, again, because of the foundations that Terry said, that it's, you know, they know where they're building it from, and the world that they've built, you know, is one where I feel any audience at any time could probably dip into that film and find a lot that they would enjoy with it.
Yeah, totally. I think that's one thing that is very much a tick in the plus column, isn't it, for this film, is that it's still very watchable and hasn't got bits that really make you, that's not going to sit well these days. I mean, obviously, I've got to say that I can say that as a man in my 50s, and so maybe someone in their 20s might think, are you serious? Do you not see that bit where, you know, yeah, so, but hey, whatever. For me, it does seem, you know, I'd be quite happy to say, yeah, go and watch Running Man. It's hilarious. It's brilliant. It's a great hour and a half of entertainment. You know, what else are you going to do?
Exactly.
To be fair, there's tons of other things that they could watch instead, if you know, to be perfectly honest with you. But I mean, they could do far worse.
They could
than watch Running Man. Far worse than what they.
Yes, it's an hour and a half of your life that you will enjoy, and that length is in the pacing is great for it as well. Popcorn.
I suppose the ending, you know, the reveal, the great reveal at the end. I guess that's a big element of fantasy, is it? Because, I mean, like, that's not how the world works, is it? You know, when our political leaders have frequently been revealed for criminals, murderers, misogynists, rapists, you know, ghastly, awful, ghastly people constantly on a daily basis, and nothing changes. So the idea that society changes because, like, you know, everyone realizes that the Running Man is a complete and utter fake, you know, that's not, you know, and the inference that perhaps this is a big world moment. But let's, you know, it's a work of fantasy. May I just please say that the soundtrack is incredibly noteworthy. This is a yes. Harold Faltermeyer soundtrack, of which he did a few at the time, but he didn't do that many. I have a copy of this soundtrack. It's excellent. It's absolutely brilliant. An electronic soundtrack. Of course, yes, if you're going to do a dystopian film, then you've got to have an electronic soundtrack. Absolutely. And so, it, you know, that's big trope tick there. It's particularly good. And if you do like your soundtracks, then you should definitely seek that one out, particularly if you like your electronica. A lot of fun.
But yeah, you make that nowadays and it's got some Hans Zimmer soundtrack on it, and yeah, it just doesn't work, does it? But the pumping synth track on the at the start of every action sequence, it's great. And of course his own version of Wagner's Flight of the Valkyries is
absolutely, yeah, it's up there. It's part of the ages. That is definitely one of the highlights of the movie's soundtrack, and a worthy addition to the Wagner canon, it's got to be said.
Yeah, the soundtrack, again, there's so many bits which just come together, and it's funny because it feels like you've got a film which is in some places less than the sum of its parts, and then in other places much more than the sum of its parts, which is it's a funny film in that it straddles two worlds, not necessarily brilliantly, but enough with enough panache and enough enjoyability that you can just sit here and go, yeah, this is fun. It is just pure fun. And you know, at the end of the day, this is why we go to watch movies. We watch movies to enjoy ourselves. And this is a hugely, hugely enjoyable film. That's my summing up, Terry. It's just, you know, you go to watch this film fun. And I watched it slightly half cut after coming back from the pub and went, this is the perfect type of film for it. This is perfect, you know, late night ITV4 fodder where I can sit down, my brain doesn't have to engage, and I'm going to enjoy it no matter what state of mind I'm in at the moment. And, you know, is that not all you want from a movie, really? Job done in so many ways.
It's certainly what we want for the action movie Landfill, Gary. It was an outstanding choice.
Thank you. I feel like I've redeemed myself from before. And Graham, you know, how final thoughts from you in terms of how, you know, is this a perfect action movie Landfill that deserves to be rescued from landfill and held up aloft?
Certainly. Dig this one out of the landfill. This shouldn't have been gone in there. It's got to go back on the shelf. It is a worthy action film of the era.
Yeah.
Yep, take off its collar. It's free to go.
Yes, it's on its way to Hawaii right now.
So that was my choice. Graham, it is your turn to delve into the depths of the landfill, to delve into the four quadrant Quake Arena and see what DVD are lying in various locker rooms along with past winners, or maybe have just been left lying around in, you know, TV production studios as raw footage. Where are you going? Where do we dive into next in the landfill?
Well, okay. You pulled us back into the safe territory. I'm going to push us back into the unsafe territory.
Oh, blimey.
Not too far. And this is an action film, but it thinks it's more than it is. Okay, so, but... So I'm taking you to the mid-90s, and I'm going to take you to a time where people thought, actually, we could put a lot of money into an action film. We could get some proper actors to come in and do it as well. And actually, not just proper actors, the biggest actors. So I'm going to take you to 1995, and I'm going to choose Michael Mann's crime heist action drama, Heat.
Okay, it's been a long time since I've seen that film.
And it's going to take you a while as well, because it's nearly 3 hours long.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
Michael Mann. Yeah. Michael Mann.
It better have a lot, as much action as I remember it has.
I'm very much for this. You've actually picked one of my favourite movies there. I've sat through 3 hours of that many times.
So is it worthy for landfill discussion then, Gary, for you?
Well, if I picked out Kiss Bang Bang, I think you are entirely entitled to pick out Heat in there. And there is, you know, maybe the action elements are a few and far between, but the action elements are in there. We'll talk about this, but the bank robbery gunfight chase is probably up there with some of the best sequences, and I cannot wait to rewatch this again. And, you know, even though it's going to be action movie, I suspect we're going to spend a lot of time talking about a coffee shop in the next film, next podcast.
You know, I don't think I've seen it.
Ooh, well,
no, I haven't seen it. I've literally just ordered the Blu-ray right now.
Have you?
Thanks to the miracle of the internet, I have literally ordered the Blu-ray right now. I tried to make a habit of owning the films in the landfill.
Okay. It is on Netflix.
Because DVDs are so cheap now. It's true. Okay. But I'm sure it's on a streaming service. But I kind of like, if possible, getting the DVD. Mm-hmm. And I did it with The Running Man. We had a streaming copy of The Running Man. But I like, it's a nice little tradition to get the DVD and, you know, sit down with it on a DVD, you know, or a Blu-ray in this instance.
I've got a story to be behind it, because I was in a bar in Reims, in France last year. I was in a champagne bar, because as my young colleagues often remind me, I have a very bougie lifestyle, and in this bar behind they had a TV screen and they were playing Heat. So I watched about half an hour with the sound off of it, and I thought, and it was the bank heist bit, and I thought, I think this is landfill worthy. So yeah, that's why I picked it for. And I don't think I've seen it since the 90s. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how it goes. It's a very 90s. It's a Michael Mann film. It's extremely 90s.
I don't get on with my, I said I don't get on with Michael Mann films. I think there may be a few that I've seen. Like I remember when I'd see Manhunter. Do you remember that movie?
Oh yeah,
which is like a Hannibal Lecter film. And it just wound me up because completely I just didn't appreciate his filmmaking style. And did he make The Keep as well? Is that another one of his? I can't remember. Anyway, sorry. So it could well be that the next episode of Level could be me working through my Michael Mann issues. In the same way that we've helped Gary work through his Moonraker issues. Associated daddy issues going on with my Michael Mann thing. But, I mean, nevertheless, I'm hoping it's still going to be a process. So this is, yeah, there's going to be some narrative in the next podcast. It's got to be said. Narrative. Let's try and fantastic. Keep it. I can't wait.
Yeah, we'll try and keep it less than 3 hours.
6 hours, man. 6 hours. Yes.
We won't be doing a director's a landfill commentary on Heat, I don't think. Although Terry, this is a teaser for a future one as well, because Terry is just talking about daddy issues. I might actually, for my next pick in a few times, pick my mum's favourite action movie film.
Is
one of her favourites.
Are you going to tell us what it is, or is it going to keep it a surprise?
It's very 90s.
Ooh,
is all I can say. And
okay.
Yeah, and it's got. It's got a very 90s cast in it as well. But she saw it on TV one night and came back and went rave and went, this is a fantastic film. And my mother is not a particularly big action film fan.
Okay.
She absolutely loved this one. So it's, it's got the most two of the most 90s stars you can imagine in it as well.
All right. Well, we've got me to do after that, so you'll have to wait, unfortunately.
I will. But I feel I've dropped that teaser in there, and I'll drop it in again next time, and you can keep minding me. But all I can say is I think from my memory, my mother may have quite good taste.
Okie dokie, then.
Anyway, I will leave you on that piece of intrigue in there. If you've enjoyed this podcast, and haven't seen The Running Man, actually, I think we'd all just say, go out and watch it. It's 90 minutes of your life that you really will not regret, especially if it's just, you know, you're looking for something to watch in the evening. It is on Netflix, I think. I watched it on Netflix. So, you know, sit down, watch it. You're not going to regret it in there, especially if you're just spending time going, what do I want to watch? This is your perfect film for it. So go ahead and watch it if you haven't. If you have, let us know on the various social media profiles of what you think of it. You know, obviously there are better films, but this is an enjoyable one. This one is Rescue from Landfill. So thanks for your time. Hopefully we've inspired you to check out a not exactly a classic, but one that might have been a little bit forgotten in relation to other Arnie films. And yes, next time we will sit down with Mr. Pacino and Mr. De Niro and have a cup of coffee. And yes, 3 hours long. So gentlemen, I mean, all I can say is that I hope that you've got your legs crossed and you haven't stocked up on too much water or beer before the movie, because that could be problematic. Until then, thank you very much. I've been Gary Andrews. Who do you love, Graham?
Gary!
Who do you love, Terry?
Gary!
I could have been killing you in another life. Absolutely. thank you very much for listening, dear listeners, and we'll be back soon with more Action Movie Landfill and more Hodger Pod. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.